Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from several different sources. I'm going to start with a continuation of an article from AARP, the magazine, that we started last year. A Tale of Two Grandmas. Grandma Ruth did aerobics, ate vegetables, had legions of friends, and two great loves. She made aging look easy. Grandma Charlotte was the opposite, a homebody who preferred the comforts of faith and family. She endured life more than reveled in it. However, they both lived to be 104 years old. So now we're looking at the faith part of their lives. Tom Cole has spent decades studying what keeps people going in their later years. The rabbi and co-author of the Oxford Book of Aging sees longevity through a different lens than most researchers do. Beyond genetics and lifestyle, he argues, there's something more fundamental, the power of belief itself. I don't think you can live to an old age without a belief system, Cole says. Whether that's religious faith or simply a deep conviction that tomorrow holds promise. This framework of belief, he explains, creates a kind of spiritual resilience, an inner force that helps people push forward through life's darkest moments. Cole has found this particularly true among Holocaust survivors and others who have faced severe hardship. Many describe moments of profound connection that sustained them, a guiding voice, an unseen presence, a warm light that appeared when all seemed lost. The science backs this up. Research from Ohio State University found that religious affiliation alone can add as much as 9 years to a person's life. A separate study showed women who regularly attended religious services had a 33% lower mortality rate. But the power of belief extends beyond religion. What matters is having something meaningful to believe in, whether it's family, community, or a personal mission. Whether faith or optimism, it's common among people who live a long time. Boston University School of Medicine psychologist Luena Lee's research reveals that people who maintained a positive outlook had 50 to 70% greater odds of reaching age 85 than the least optimistic groups in her study. Likewise, those who embrace the positive aspect of aging, such as accumulated wisdom and emotional maturity, live an average of 7.6 years longer than those who don't. Yale public health psychologist Becca Levy found that these optimistic individuals gain their advantage through multiple pathways. They exercise more, make healthier food choices, and show lower levels of stress-related inflammation in their bodies. These benefits mirror those seen in highly conscientious people, suggesting that our mental outlook shapes our physical reality. Deborah Cato, co-director of the Stanford Center on Longevity, sees this play out in her oldest patients. She routinely asks them what they look forward to, and their answers reveal how the prospect keeps them going. A grandchild's visit, lunch with a neighbor, a weekly game of Rummikub with friends. These anticipations become anchors, Cato explains. They give life its forward momentum. She tells me about a 105-year-old who fractured her hip but was determined to attend her great-granddaughter's wedding. That single goal, that belief in a future moment, mobilized not just her recovery but her entire family's support network. Having something meaningful on the calendar, Cato says, can literally add days to your life. Both my grandmothers embodied different forms of this life-sustaining belief. Ruth lived for approach goals, always anticipating the next gathering, the next travel experience or holiday. Charlotte found her anchor in a conscientious affinity for ritual. Meticulously scrubbing her stove, triple wrapping her egg salad, never missing prayer time. Her deep faith that these actions would keep her and her family safe and keep the evil eye at bay lent structure to her days. Though their beliefs took different forms, both provided a spiritual foundation that gave them meaning late into life. And the last part of this article is entitled The Limits of Age. Pearls, who runs the New England Centenarian Study, has a life expectancy calculator on his website, Living to 100. It asks 40 quick questions about health and family history and then estimates how long you might live, along with tips to add more years. When I tried it, the results said I should expect to live to 104. My first reaction? Amazing, just like my grandmother's. My second? I'd better start saving. The truth is, even with all the tools and data at our disposal, we still don't fully comprehend what stands between us and the numbers on those tables. Some experts believe we've hit a natural limit on age span. In October, S.J. Olshansky, a leading researcher at the University of Illinois Chicago, concluded, in the absence of forthcoming aging interventions, as long as we live now is about as long as we're going to live. His study predicts that maximum human life expectancy will plateau around 87 years, 84 for men, 90 for women. Many countries are already closing in on those averages. This conversation is reframing how we think about aging. The focus is shifting from simply extending life to improving the quality of the years we have. For instance, health organizations typically recommend scaling back cancer screenings at certain ages, prostate cancer at 70, breast cancer at 75, colonoscopies at 85, on the assumption that these tests might not significantly improve outcomes. Pearls disagrees. At any age, why die of something if we have the tools to identify and treat it, he asks. Barzilai is looking beyond prevention to what he calls gerotherapeutics, medicines designed to target the aging process by reducing inflammation and repairing cellular damage. Some of these treatments are already in use. GLP-1 medications like Ozempic and Wegovy, originally developed for diabetes and obesity, show promise in reducing the risks of heart disease, Parkinson's, and Alzheimer's. Combined with exercise, nutrition, sleep, and meaningful social connections, these advances could help us enjoy the longest possible health span, as Barzilai calls it. Both my grandmothers, different as they were, managed to do just that. Grandma Ruth, the extrovert and explorer, lived fully until the end. On a trip to Paris in her late 90s, she brushed away offers at the airport to sit in a wheelchair. "Don't treat me like an old lady," she said. Grandma Charlotte, the cautious and inwardly focused survivor, endured with equal strength. Up until the end, she was scrubbing her dishes clean and saying her prayers at the breakfast table. In their own ways, they represent what's possible over a very long life, but not in ways that fit neatly into any prescription or blueprint. After all my research, I'm convinced that neither of them was right and neither was wrong. My family and society created a narrative of contrast that seemed to make sense, but doesn't. Ruth was the shining example, and Charlotte the anomaly. But the reality is more nuanced. Longevity doesn't obey the simple scripts we impose on it. Both grandmothers found their own ways to persist, and both ways delivered. Ultimately, lasting vitality isn't about conforming to expectations or explanations. It's about finding a way to hold on to meaning, purpose, and life itself, in whatever way works for you. The author of this piece was David Hochman, a longtime contributing editor for AARP the magazine and the Bulletin. His byline appears in the New York Times, Forbes, GQ, Food and Wine, and many other publications. And now we're going back to another article entitled Pain-Free for Life. In an exclusive excerpt adapted from his new book, It Doesn't Have to Hurt, Sanjay Gupta reveals an array of medications and techniques that offer hope for those who live with chronic pain. And so far we've looked at how to manage your pain toolbox, your body's natural painkillers, healing with meat, temperature therapy, supplements, and now we're going to look at non-opioid analgesic medications. Let's take a look in your medicine cabinet and get a sense of what's on hand. Acetaminophen, found in Tylenol, Feverol, and Panadol, an analgesic medication that works in the brain to increase the body's pain threshold and change the way the body senses pain. It also works to bring down fever and regulate body temperature. It's best for headaches, muscle aches, sore throat, toothaches, backaches, sprains, and strains. Best painkiller for people with gastrointestinal issues. Do not use for nerve pain or inflammatory conditions. Avoid if you are a heavy drinker or have existing liver issues. Take no more than 1,000 milligrams at a time and no more than 4,000 milligrams over a 24-hour period to avoid liver issues. Then there's ibuprofen, Advil, Motrin, Midol, Naproxen, Aleve, Naproxen, and Naprolan. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, NSAIDs, that reduce fever and block prostaglandins, compounds that cause pain and inflammation. Consult your doctor to determine your dosage and frequency of use that's best for you. It's best used for headaches and musculoskeletal pain, arthritis, toothaches, backaches, and sunburn. These may be safer choices than aspirin for those with bleeding risk, but are still associated with gastrointestinal issues. Do not use for nerve pain. Avoid if you take blood thinners or have uncontrolled high blood pressure, heart failure, ulcers, or liver or kidney disease. Aspirin, an NSAID that stops the production of prostaglandins, which cause pain and inflammation. It also reduces fever and blood clotting. Best for headaches, arthritis, toothaches, muscle aches, sprains, and strains. Do not use for wounds or bruises. Aspirin may promote bleeding or nerve pain. Avoid if you take blood thinners or have uncontrolled high blood pressure, kidney disease, ulcers, or other bleeding risks. Topical pain relievers. Analgesics that temporarily relieve pain at the skin's surface. A topical NSAID called diclofenac, sodium topical gel, 1%, Voltaren, and over-the-counter as a generic drug, can be effective for joint pain. Best for nerve pain and soft tissue injuries. Do not use for wounds or open sores. Avoid if you are allergic to lidocaine, aspirin, or NSAIDs, or if you have liver or heart issues. An important reminder, always tell your doctor about any supplement you're taking, as even over-the-counter products might cause concerning drug interactions. This is tool number 6, non-opioid prescriptions. We've seen remarkable progress since the days when opioids and steroids were used to treat most pain maladies. For instance, sodium channel blockers. Just this year, the FDA approved Jornax, the first drug in a new class of non-opioid pain medicines, While opioids primarily work by dulling sensations in the brain, the new drug in 50 milligram oral tablets is reported to reduce pain by targeting a pain signaling pathway in the peripheral nervous system before the pain signals reach the brain. The discovery of this drug has a fascinating backstory. More than two decades ago, researchers learned about a boy in Pakistan who could walk on hot coals without flinching. Researchers found and examined three families from the same region with offspring who could not feel pain. It wasn't that they were numb. Rather, it was just the pain-conducting nerves that were affected. That observation led to further investigation, the identification of a gene mutation unique to these families, and ultimately helped inspire the development of the new medication. Gabapentin, originally developed as an anticonvulsant, it helps manage neuropathic pain by regulating how pain messages travel from the brain through the spinal cord and reducing the excitability of nerve cells in the brain. Gabapentin, sold under the brand name Horzant, Gralice, and Neurontin, was approved for treatment of neuropathic pain more than 20 years ago, but it is far from a perfect drug. It works best for post-therapeutic neuralgia, a combination of shingles, a complication of shingles. Evidence for other types of neuropathic pain is very limited. Then we have antidepressants. It's not clear why they help relieve pain for some people. What is clear is that they take a long time to work, sometimes up to several weeks, and even then, not every drug works for every issue. A 2023 meta-analysis concluded that the only antidepressant we are certain about for the treatment of chronic pain is Cymbalta. It was moderately effective across all outcomes at the standard dose. Next, we have medical interventions and medication management. The following are some of many available options for pain relief and management. Neuromodulation, including spinal cord stimulation, an implanted device that sends low levels of electricity directly into the spinal cord to relieve pain. Deep brain stimulation and local external electrical stimulation, applying brief pulses of electricity to nerve endings over the skin to provide pain relief, scrambler therapy or TENS. Injection therapies, in which medication is injected directly into the site of the discomfort. These include epidural steroid injections, nerve blocks, joint injections, and trigger point injections. Dry needling, which can be initially painful, involves placing thin, sharp needles through the skin and into what are known as trigger points, areas of muscles that have become knotted and tender. The needling can decrease tightness, improve blood flow, and reduce pain. It's called dry because there are no medications in the needle. Non-painkiller injections, they may include Botox, gel injections, often used for knee pain, such as mild to moderate arthritis, prolotherapy injections, concentrated sugar water to relieve pain in joints, ligaments, and tendons, regenerative medicine, like orthobiologics, a newer category, including injectables made from your own blood or tissue, or application of dressings using biomaterials, such as placenta, used to restore tissue in skin grafts and other wounds or surgical sites, platelet-rich plasma injections, and cell therapy, PRP, injections involve taking the patient's blood, isolating and concentrating the platelets, and injecting billions of them into the joint, ligament, or tendons. Some newer injectables, called cell therapies, collect cells and tissues from bone marrow or fat tissue. The cells are collected, cleansed, and injected into the patient's joint, ligaments, or tendons. Then we have the psychological approaches, clinical hypnosis with a trained therapist, self-hypnosis, mindfulness-based pain management, and other mind-body approaches are among several techniques that have been shown to help some people not only manage pain, but also improve sleep, eating habits, exercise choices to support a more active lifestyle, and relationship dynamics. The most frequently applied therapy approaches include cognitive behavioral therapy for chronic pain, acceptance and commitment therapy, pain reprocessing therapy, emotional awareness and expression therapy. Options for psychological services are growing dramatically as the medical community has awakened to their value and the need to make them more accessible for patients. In addition to one-on-one therapy and group therapy, other options are programs or sessions by telehealth, online apps, and other digital platforms. Then we have cannabis and ketamine. In some treatment areas, including certain areas of epilepsy, symptoms of multiple sclerosis, nausea, and opioid use disorder, cannabis may be effective. When it comes to pain, however, the data is less compelling. And of course, cannabis is not legal for use everywhere. After reviewing several random controlled trials, here's how I would summarize the findings. Some studies suggest cannabis may provide some relief for chronic pain. However, results are mixed. There were other benefits, such as patients opting for smaller doses of opiates, suggesting a synergetic effect of cannabis with other pain meds. Wherever you come down on the idea of cannabis use for pain, you should talk to your doctor about it. Ketamine is not a new drug, even if you've just started hearing about it. In the 1970s, it was used as a battlefield anesthetic during the Vietnam War. In recent years, however, there has been research into using ketamine as a possible treatment for depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and chronic pain. In 2019, researchers published a systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials evaluating the effectiveness of intravenous ketamine for those with chronic pain. The conclusion was that while it provides significant short-term analgesic benefit in these patients, larger multi-center studies with longer follow-ups were needed. And finally, acupuncture, yoga, meditation, and more. Complementary and integrative health options round out your toolbox. These health approaches are not just for pain. They're used to improve sleep, stress management, general wellness, energy, and immune health, all of which play a role in pain. Think of it as engaging the body's own resources, from our naturally occurring endogenous opioids to the brain's learning processes, as well as therapies and practices that engage those processes on command, our personal command. We need to continue to frame pain management and prevention in the context of our own biological and behavioral arsenal, rather than solely on the conventional focus on pills, patches, needles, and procedures. The author of this piece was Sanjay Gupta, a doctor, a neurosurgeon, author, and chief medical correspondent for CNN. Adapted from It Doesn't Have to Hurt, Your Smart Guide to a Pain-Free Life by Sanjay Gupta, MD, copyright 2025. Now let's look at a quick money matter question. AARP's financial etiquette columnist has advice for people confronted with some awkward situations. Question. My husband and I offered to pay for our son's wedding, but we made the mistake of not giving him a budget. The choices he has made are very expensive. A high-end caterer, a 12-person band, even a wedding cake that costs $1,500. How do we set a spending limit at this point? Asking to have a conversation is a great way to begin, since it sets a tone of respect and ensures you can speak with your son when he can be attentive. Be clear about what you want to discuss. Seth, I would like to have a conversation with you about the wedding expenses. Once you're together or on a call, be both candid and kind, drawing confidence from the fact that you are in control of your own finances. I want to apologize, you might say. I'm sorry that in the excitement of your engagement, we didn't set a budget for your wedding, and what your father and I are willing to contribute. I realize that can make wedding planning more difficult. We are going to give you a lump sum of what we're willing to contribute to the wedding, and you and Joni can spend it how you wish. Whether you're more comfortable with a lump sum or paying for specific expenses, being clear is the key. Why apologize? Because you have caused, albeit unintentionally, a misconception, and your kid might feel blindsided. Even if his expectations were unrealistic, we're talking eye-popping unrealistic, he and his fiancé have spent time in a dreamland, and receiving this information could feel like you're pulling a 180 on them. Have this difficult conversation as soon as possible. Delaying will only give your son and his partner more time to fall in love with things that are outside your budget. It will also increase the chances that less expensive options will be booked up. Then, when the special day arrives, celebrate and treat yourself to a nice big slice of that wedding cake. Well, we have time for a couple of money-saving tips. These fall under the heading of utilities and energy. Maximize your smart thermostat. You're leaking money if you've only set up some basic programming. Features such as sensors or geofencing can track when you come and go and adjust your home temperature accordingly. Your monthly usage summaries can provide clues for how to save even more. Remember, heating and cooling typically account for about half of your electric bill. Charge your car smartly. EV owners can often save by charging their vehicles during off-peak hours, including overnight. What's more, if you plan to install a car charger at home, find out if your utility company offers rebate programs. Give up some control. More consumers are ceding more power over their home's electricity to use their utility provider during peak demand times in exchange for credit or savings on their bill. So at 5 p.m. on a hot day, your utility company may dial down your usage a bit. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join me next time. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.